all your major docks. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Live streaming today from under heavily drenched South Korean skies, you're listening to episode 60 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. What's in store for listeners this week? Not quite Christmas. It's Buddha's birthday. Taking a roundtable approach with a virtual gathering of Dharmic minds, the speaker panel we've lined up for you includes two former guests and friends of the show, fellow South Korean expats, Professor David Mason and Aaron Wadsworth. Proving that Sin City clearly has at least a few decent things to offer, Las Vegas-based Todd Jackson will also hopefully be dropping by. So join us now, as over the next 90 minutes or so, we do our best to unlock the age-old secrets of Korea's Gaya Confederacy and Asia's historic Silk Road connection, bridging the ancient east to west, including all things Greco-Buddhism. Making our way here down onto the docks of Skullport Harbor, I thought I'd actually even seen a group of Korean monks somewhere in the area. Wasn't too sure what that was all about. Oh, wait a minute. Of course, it's Buddha's birthday. Makes total sense now, doesn't it? So, I also think we do have a couple of our guests have managed to make it down here. Joining us today as well, we've got Dr. David Mason making a return visit once again, as well as Aaron Wadsworth, although I think Aaron's having some technical issues from his end of things on Skype. Hopefully managed to get that sorted out before too long. And of course, a new visitor, someone who's making his first appearance here with us on Pirate Radio Podcast, Todd Jackson. Todd, how are things in Las Vegas today?
Things are hot in Las Vegas, but otherwise pleasant, and we're looking forward to a drop in temperature from a balmy 104 down to the mid-70s tomorrow, which will be nice because it's my birthday as well as the Buddha's.
Wow. How about that? How auspicious. Yes. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. David, technical end of things, I think we're doing a little better than last year where we had a pretty Mickey Mouse setup as far as the recording end of things was concerned. We even had phones ringing during the middle of our discussion and everything. So can you hear me?
Yes, this seems to be coming through quite clearly.
That's excellent. Yeah, you remember last year, that was one of the earlier episodes that we did, in fact, so had a little frustrating to say the least. We finally managed to get it all put together, though. So why don't we just go around? We're still once again waiting for Aaron to drop by. Even in fact, Lord Stompy, I believe, had been trying to get in touch and work on joining us here up in the Crow's Nest today. We'll have to just sit tight until he does show up before we're probably actually able to set sail and leave the harbor. Before we get into the biographical end of things, Todd, you've got a pirate story, I guess, that you're going to be sharing with us here. It's just a technical kind of formality to go along with the show, more or less. But what do you have in mind exactly?
Well, it's a pirate story. I'll decline to tell you about the numerous ships I've sacked and things of that manner, and simply point out that I actually grew up in Pittsburgh and therefore am a Pirates fan. And actually, as a boy, I attended the last baseball game the Pirates played in not Three Rivers Stadium, but Forbes Field. If there are any baseball fans out there, they'll be gasping at my advanced age right now.
I used to, myself as a kid, be a big Willie Stargell fan. He used to play for the Pirates, didn't he?
Yes, he did. We knew him, actually. He was a friend of the family.
Didn't he pass away a couple years ago?
more than a couple of years ago, mid-80s.
I see.
He was a wonderful man.
Yeah.
Late 80s.
I don't know. I just, there's something about him. I just kind of, I like, you know, the name had a nice ring to it, and he was a pretty decent player as well. So this is going back a few years, of course.
That's right.
Too, but yeah, great childhood memories. So, okay, a little more on topic now, and back to the point and show at hand. David, why don't we just, if we could, allow you to present to our listeners just a quick overview of your biographical information and credentials and whatnot.
Well, I've been in Korea for around 33 years, since the early 1980s, and have been a Korean studies guy, pretty much researching the traditional culture, especially religious and spiritual culture, and doing a lot of traveling in the mountains. So that led me to write and publish 10 different books and a whole bunch of academic papers, magazine articles and such. I've been a writer about it, and finally the government hired me for the Ministry of Tourism here, worked there for 5 years, and then became a professor of tourism, working on Korean tourism issues, and development, and educating international students about that. It's been a hell of a ride, really. Korea through all kinds of ups and downs.
33 years is what it says here as well, your bio handout that you sent along to me. Quite appropriate, I would have to say, especially as far as the surname Mason is concerned. That's a big number for those folks, 32s and 33s and whatnot. So we're getting a little bit of electronic interference there. Maybe when people aren't talking here on the panel, if you could maybe mute yourselves or either just generally kind of turn your speakers down. I think how the trick works is you point them out from one another, if that's how you're set up from an audio kind of technical end of things, and we can kind of help to reduce the electronic interference. Todd, yeah, I just got your bio just a few minutes ago, actually. It really kind of blew my mind. Why don't you share a little bit of the background details with people that are listening to today's show?
Certainly. I used to be a college instructor myself. I have a master's, and I'm overeducated in subjects which have absolutely nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight. However, I've done what a lot of people have been doing with their lives the last 10 years or so, which is principally spending too much time on Facebook. In that process, I've been a Hellenic polytheist for the past 15 years. I've started, I guess not quite 15 years ago, more like 12 years ago, an online prayer circle by the name of Kyklos Apollon, dedicated to the Olympian god Apollo. I turned to religion itself a couple of decades earlier than that, through Soka Gakkai Buddhism. That connection didn't last, and I was adrift for quite some time until Apollo and I became acquainted. One of the principal efforts that I've been involved in has been the group Nia Gandhara, which I started a little more than 5 years ago now on Facebook. And I also have another group which is more of an online mandala, by the name of Tetralemma Sun Mandala. And that occupies a great deal of my time. And it's through those latter two connections that I've been expressing my interest in this connection between Buddhism and Hellenism that collided in the Gandhara region of Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Indeed. In fact, the very same region where we seem to see so much upheaval and conflict, bloodshed, unfortunately, at not only the present moment, but it's been the case now for the last number of how many ever years, I'm not sure. Perhaps even you could go back as far as, well, it's all relative, I suppose, isn't it? But a real, definitely, ratcheting up of tensions and issues in that area. Very sad, especially when we hear stories about the destruction of ancient artifacts and things like that.
Yes.
From the region.
Yes, you have to be a very bold person to be an archaeologist in that part of the world.
Indeed. And that's, you know, there's actually, for people that are interested, there are quite a few decent quality documentaries that they can find via YouTube and whatnot, dealing with these matters as well, the Gandhar region and so forth. Even Afghanistan, you know, I did not, until the time that the, I guess, who was it, Al-Qaeda had bombed, or at least a faction or a wing within Al-Qaeda, decided that it would be a really great idea to bomb the Bamiyan Buddhas. I had no idea. And I'd been up to that point studying Buddhism, you know, was practicing sort of lazy Buddhist for over 10 years, and no idea whatsoever that, in fact, Buddhism had found its way and been active in the Afghanistan, I guess what back then, during that time, would be referred to as Bactrian region of the world. So that was quite a mind-blower.
JFE.
Yes, sir.
Actually, that was the Taliban.
That's why we have you folks here today. I'm just a facilitator, not the expert. All I can do is just, yeah. They say you throw enough mud out against the wall and something's bound to stick. Yeah. Close.
That was an extremely active Buddhist area as part of the Silk Road. Emperor Ashoka controlled that Afghanistan area as early as 250 BC and sending missionaries up that way and such. And then that's one of the routes by which you can get through the Himalaya Mountains and over to the desert basin that leads to China.
Taklamakan, I think is, yeah.
Yeah. Taklamakan Desert, which translates as, if you go in, you don't come out.
Oh, I can believe that. You know, and speaking of which, and we're going to be all over the map here, obviously, today. So, but just having mentioned this, following our footsteps as we make our journey, maybe more by land than anything else, but we'll play that one by ear. Red-headed mummies that were discovered in that area. I'm guessing at least one or two of you have seen these productions that have been put together, something that China really, I guess, the communist central government there in Beijing has supposedly worked quite hard in covering up, the so-called red-haired mummies of the Taklamakan Desert. Either of you heard of that, Todd, perhaps?
I've heard something about those mummies, but I hear more, actually, about the actual descendants of the Greeks, of Alexander the Great's army, in fact. The Kalash people who still reside in that part of the world and are very seriously threatened. Oh, I think we have Aaron with us. So there are not only red-headed mummies, but there are red-headed living people there who descend from, they're not Buddhists themselves. They are some sort of post Hellenic polytheist, but they're still out there.
Whoa, and they're not Muslim?
No, they're not.
Wow.
Which is why they're so endangered, unfortunately.
How about that? Some obscure ancient sect of some sort or another, as you say, descending from the Ptolemaic, I'm not sure. There's different, of course, Alexander when his empire crumbled, or I guess his absolute reign ended, his generals took over, so that's quite amazing. How about that? Stompy, let's just see. I see your light seems to be going on and off there. So perhaps we've got you here on board finally. Have you made it up into the crow's nest?
I certainly have, Jaffe. I've had to go back to my crappy quality microphone because for some reason my good quality one doesn't want to play ball.
Don't worry about it. It's good to have you here just as someone who's able to help hold down the fort, not a problem. You're actually sounding okay for the time being. I'm not sure how much you're going to be able to contribute to this conversation, but do feel free to chime in whenever you like. Just give me a quick heads up there in the chat area, and we'll take it from there, of course.
I have studied more the Tibetan schools of Buddhism quite a lot, and I've done a lot of Taoist study, and I'm actually friends with the Tibetan refugees, so I have actually played about three or four times. I've been a guest of honor at the Dalai Lama's birthday when the Tibetans have put that on in town. So even if I can't contribute much, I'm here in spirit.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot to offer, for sure, as always. So never underestimate Stompy. Of course, I'm guessing both of you, maybe even Aaron, if, as Todd hinted at, did manage to make it on board here today, be able to detect and tell that, of course, Stompy is based out of Australia. Why don't you just give them a quick introduction there, Stompy, as to who, your bit of your background, who you are, where you come from, and how it is that you managed to find your way onto the Robin Hood here, hooking up with Pirate Radio Podcasts.
Yeah, hi guys. Sorry I'm a little bit late. I was trying to hook up my microphone, my good one, that wasn't happening. I kind of ran into Jaffe on Minds.com because I have some conservative views. How do I describe? It's very hard for me to describe myself. I'm an artist, so I have a foot in no camp. Really.
Damn artists, huh? Yeah, they're hard to pin down.
Yeah, I'm just with the flow of the greater reality as much as I can be. So with a lot of the political things happening and the very rapidly changing social landscape here in the West, I've been speaking out on a range of issues, and I found I've lost a lot of my old friends. That's all right, I'm getting some new friends. But part of the reason I've been out of the loop, Jaffe, is our band was starting to get some fairly high-profile gigs and do some good stuff, and this is the kind of cuckery that's really bogging down Western society at the moment. We were supporting some international people and starting to get some really good reviews, and then about a week and a half ago, our guitarist left the band on the grounds that my views are far too extreme for him to be in a band and to be associated with me.
Yeah. You've been struggling with some health issues, too, I guess, from what you were saying, just in the private messaging area there. So hopefully.
I sure am. Yeah. And I'm copying it from every direction because I have had a lot of Buddhist and Taoist philosophy in my life. It's essentially, it's a spiritual system for the mind is the way I see it. And in the last, 6 months or so, I've been turning to a lot of Christian philosophy, and on top of that, I've lost a few friends over that as well. So, and I'm not a garden variety Christian. I'm a very open-minded. I don't agree with certain tenets that are very common with the Christian faith. So at this moment in history here in the West, we're at a point where the free thinkers and people with well-formulated, strong opinions on many issues are actually being marginalized by the social milieu.
Well, it certainly would seem to be the case. We're going to, politics aside, we could maybe get into more of that later, but hey, I'm sure there's probably a lot of our listeners, as well as maybe even Todd or David, I can't really speak for anyone else, of course, but these are rather esoteric matters that we are going to be getting more into here today, and not your typical mainstream sort of issues or ideas or areas of study or an investigation. So I wouldn't feel too alone. In fact, you say you've perhaps, it feels like, lost a few friends. Maybe today, before the show has ended, you'll discover you've actually found a few new friends. So cheer up. Today's some good karma, maybe, hopefully
it's
coming.
It's all part of the great wheel, Jaffe. The great wheel of Dharma.
The wheel of rebirth and all those other sort of good things. David, just quickly, I got to mention this, of course, because I've been staring at it here for the last few minutes, but around your neck there, you've got, I believe, is that not the three jewels, the ancient symbol that you're wearing, the medallion? If can't really see it too clearly, but is that not what it is, the Buddha Dharma Sangha?
Are you speaking to me?
Yes, sir, Mr. Mason.
Actually, that's a Chinese medallion with the eight trigrams of the I Ching on it. South Korea has four of those symbols on its national flag.
Yin and Yang, and what do those four stand for, just quickly?
Heaven, earth, fire, and water.
And the other four that are a part of your medallion?
Mountain, lake, thunder, rising. And river, the abysmal. These are from the I Ching, the oldest book of Chinese thought, philosophy, going back 3,000 years ago, and kind of the root of all Taoism and Confucianism and Chinese style of Buddhism.
Indeed. That is, a very well-known book. Have you ever yourself, I'm not sure if anyone, I've got two copies of the I Ching here. One is a Buddhist I Ching, another is given to me by a friend. More, I guess, it's the Confucian style. So that really, has anyone ever tossed the coins or used the yarrow sticks? And the Todd, have you ever turned to the I Ching for any big questions you've got?
No, actually, when I have questions of that nature, I use something known as the Homer Oracle, which descends from the Egyptian, actually it's called the Greek magical papyrus, but it is actually Hellenistic and Egyptian in origin. And I do something very similar. What it is, it lays out passages from Homer in a relatively random pattern. And you find the pattern that you need through, in my case, simply throwing some dice.
Six-sided dice?
Pig's knuckles are preferable.
Pig's knuckles. perfect for the pirate ship. I'm sure the crew would love that.
Yeah, it's just working in kosher company, obviously.
Pig's knuckles. Oh, God. Yeah, we're
I've done the coins many times. I was actually very good at it because I've got a very good feel for the trigrams. And I've got a good feel for people's energy. Just on a quick side note, a couple of times I've been to a messianic church which tries to study more of the patterns and the deeper meaning of the Torah. Quite interested to find that it's very similar. They've got a lot of those numerological patterns and cycles within the Torah that somewhat actually align with Taoism. So I believe that once upon a time there was a great spiritual system which analysed the patterns and the cycles in a scientific manner. And what we have now in civilizations is a kind of a broken up version of that within all the different great religions.
Could very well be the case. A lot of synchronicity is really, I think, the operative sort of principle of what people that practice these methods do subscribe to, very much like with the rune, is it rune stone or the rune system in the Nordic tradition. So, well, that's what we're kind of looking to get more into here today as we focus in particular on Korea, the Gaia Confederacy, the role of the Silk Roads, as well as the East to West. Or, if you will, let's not forget, it works both ways, of course, west to east. And I think back during the time of the Silk Roads, the time of Christ and whatnot, that was very much prevalent. I guess a really great place to start with here, as far as all this is concerned, is the Gaia Kingdom of Korea, which David Mason can hopefully... Why don't you just fill us in a little bit more as to its origins and the reign of King Sutowang, and who, in fact, many people speculate his wife was.
Okay. The Gaia came together as some tribal groupings of up to a dozen different tribal groups there on the southeastern corner of Korea, what is now Busan City over to Gimhae City, and then further along the coast. And it consolidated starting around maybe 300 A.D., becoming civilized, and by 400 or so was a confederation of tribes, not yet a kingdom, but moving towards kingdom, meaning adopting Chinese culture. And by 500 or so, they're actually a kingdom and had a line of kings until getting to near 600, where the Silla Kingdom conquered them, and it was over, just became part of Silla. Now, they had an interesting foundational myth, which we don't know the reality of, but there's some reason to think it's not a pure fantasy, that a woman appeared on a boat carrying Buddhist treasures and drifted in on the boat, came into shore there, and people took her in. She seemed to be a princess, and she got married to the man who became King Suro, and she was said to, her name is He, and there's a family line supposedly descended from her, still the He family in Korea, which would be spelled H-E-O, but many spell it like H-U-R, and put kind of an R sound on the end of that. And it is said that the old story recorded in the Samguggusa said that she was from Ayutthaya, which could mean that city in Thailand that later had that name and was a capital of Thailand and a Buddha center, but probably more meaning an ancient city of India that was one of the main Buddhist kingdom centers after King Ashoka in India, that supposedly she was from there. So either India or Southeast Asia, she's definitely not Korean, of the proto-Korean type of people who had descended from Siberia, who we can assume were the founding people of Gaia, and that she married and became the queen and had descendants. That's kind of all we know. It seems to be the kind of myth of giving legitimacy to the Kaya kingdom as a Buddhist kingdom. Back then, it didn't seem to be that you could just adopt a religion and say, well, okay, now we're a Buddhist kingdom, and that's fully legitimate. They had to claim ancient roots for it. So all the three kingdoms of Goguryeo, Baekje, and Silla, the main Korean kingdoms, they had various myths and stories showing that they were ancient Buddhist kingdoms all the way back to the time of the Buddha, that they had already been Buddhist and were just kind of rediscovering that. That seems to have been psychologically necessary for the people in the early centuries in adopting Buddhism.
Right.
Right.
My pronunciation of her name, and it can vary, of course, is Hoang Ok, which apparently means Jade Princess. But I think, yeah, pretty much is along the lines of what you're saying there, David. She came from, this is the one theory, Ayodhya, up northwest, kind of, I guess, Gandharan region, just a few hundred miles, I guess, up the Ganges into that part of the world. She sailed right down the Ganges, supposedly, with her, you know, likely probably not coming alone, passing through a place, I believe, if you look on the map, Bodh Gaya. So I think there's it's really interesting. There's that connection there. It kind of jumps out at me, I know, very much, the Gaya connection to India. But apparently it took her she did make it on her first attempt, in that there was a really severe storm that arose, and that they had to return. This all could be part of the myth as well, too. Who knows? Just the way as you kind of are hinting at there, this the elaboration and kind of confabulation, just, you know, just adding one thing onto the next and really building up a great story. But the second time, after the priests, monks, maybe Brahmins, what have you, had prayed over this stupa, which still exists on location where you can find, I'm not sure the name of the city, is it maybe Kimhae? I could be totally off the mark there. Where their tombs exist, her and Kim Sudowang? Is that where the tombs are, David? I'm not too clear on that, but the stupa is there.
Yes, in Kimhae city is kind of now the center of what is presumed to have been Kaya, and they're the ones who celebrate it most with Kaya Culture Festival. And they have a branch of a national museum system there where they show relics from the Gaya Kingdom, which are also in one room of the National Museum in Seoul. Gimhae, they do have tombs that are said to be Suro's and Queen He, but those are most probably much later designations. When the country was thoroughly Confucian, it was thought necessary to have tombs for all of the supposed founding kings in different parts of the country, and some of those are just kind of made up.
Another part of the story that I find quite interesting is how there was a number of different Gaias. I guess Kum Gaya and Day Gaya, perhaps. But there's another part of the Confederacy, a region within the Confederacy, known, as I recall, Ar Gaya, which is like an AR prefix, kind of, you know, cognate. Which, for anyone that's looked into this, of course, they know that it's the root of the word Aryan, which means noble. you know, or noble ones. And of course, anyone can be an Aryan. It doesn't matter the color of your skin or what have you, really. It's just, it's like Martin Luther King Jr. talked about, I suppose, very, very straightforward enough point that it's all about the quality of your character than what it is that you look like or what have you. So yeah, anyone can be Aryan, but Ho-Wong-Oak and, because many scholars, of course, the real kind of mainstream view of things is that Buddhism did not make its way into Korea until about, the 3rd century via the Silk Roads and these traveling monks that brought the sutras in that way. But, I mean, come on, people. There's a big ocean out there, as we pirates, of course, know all too well. Has anyone heard of Prince, we're going to kind of hopefully try to manage to tie things in a little better here, but Prince Shotoku from Japan. Todd, have you heard of him?
Yes. Yes, I've heard of Prince Shotoku, yes.
Well, I'm not sure, can you
He's
add?
Pretty famous, I think.
Pretty what, David, I'm sorry?
Famous, I think he's famous,
well
known.
All right, okay. So, Todd.
The first royal ruling person that we know of in Japan, the first real human that we can be sure of in history. The previous names of supposed emperors or royalty before him are legendary at best.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's an interesting tie-in here because supposedly he came from his family line and lineage came from Korea. And right out of the region where it all goes back to Myeongsan and this famous temple here that we have in the Toda-pukto province just outside of Iksan. And how this war, I guess, occurred, the two clashing armies, Shilla, Pekje. This is following the collapse of the Gaya Confederacy, which only occurred, apparently, after two attempted peace, would you say treaties, but basically meeting to try to strike a deal as a way of averting war. That, unfortunately, did not prove successful, so... But yeah, Myeongsan here, just outside of Iksan, is very prominent as far as all of this is concerned. In particular, well, because the royals apparently after that point, when was that? The mid 6th century or 7th century, David? And then the royals fled to the west, did they not?
Well, yes. The Myeongsan was built just after 600, and... Baekje only lasted, till about 660 before it was destroyed by Tang China and Shilla combination. So it was kind of their final glory, you might say. They had a king around 600 who was intensely devoted to Buddhism and really built up the Buddhist character of the nation, built several temples and fostered great monks. But militarily, they could not hold on.
Is that Mu Wong you're referring to? Mu Wong?
Yes, King Mu.
Okay, so they're the Shilla and the Baekje armies clashed. I guess Baekje collapsed. The royals fled to the west. Bua, I think, is the first place they ended up at. And then following there, Gongju, a little further even still.
Their first capital was in the Seoul area, and Goguryeo conquered that, and then later Shilla conquered it. But Baekje was pushed downward, pushed south, first to Gongju, and then by around 600, that was with King Mu, founded the city of Buya a little further down the river, a little further south, and that became their final capital.
Right, and the long and the short of it there, of course, is that in the end, from Gongju, I'm not sure what occurred there, but presumably they were attacked once again and sent... sailing off to Japan, and that's where we find Prince Shotoku emerging, if I'm not mistaken. And in fact, it's interesting, Todd, I know you referenced Sokamuni, is how I think the Buddha is sometimes referred to here in Korea, but the Soka clan was the family name and part of the tribe or clan for Prince Shotoku. If you can imagine that. Oh, yeah. And
I didn't know there was a Korean connection with him at all.
Oh, yeah. I've looked into it a little bit. I'm, like I said, pretty lazy when it comes to all this stuff. And I was hoping that maybe one or two of you would be able to just elaborate in some manner. But just David, is there anything more you can kind of add to that story or embellishments as far as the missing pieces that would maybe help to clarify things? And let's not forget, people, if you're totally lost at this particular moment in time, not to worry. We'll add a lot of links and whatnot to the show notes, or we can help you out as far as the spelling of these names and that sort of thing is concerned. We, of course, did add a little link there for you in the streaming YouTube live chat area. But yeah, quickly, David, if you are able,
I do not know of any link between Prince Shikoku and the Sakya clan of India. It would not be surprising to have somebody adopt a name that, if they wanted to show that they're thoroughly Buddhist, to adopt a family name in that way, in the same way that early Korean clans adopted famous Chinese family names, even though having no genetic relationship with them, just as a name of nobility. Anybody could, of course, take any noble family name they wished in the early days, and just if you can enforce it. The only thing we know for sure of that era is an actual fact from Korea, is that a Korean Buddhist monk from Shilla went over there and tutored Prince Shikoku's son, was his educational tutor, showing the close linkage, certainly, between Korean Peninsula and the development of civilization in Japan at that time.
I'm sorry, who went to tutor Shotoku?
Shotoku's son was tutored by a Buddhist monk from Shilla, and we do know his name, and we have records about him. I don't remember the name right now, but that's in the ancient record, the Samguk Yusa, the history. We have that pretty firmly established, that a monk from Shilla traveled there, and presumably bringing more advanced Buddhist teachings, and was installed as the tutor to the royalty's son.
If I might, go ahead.
No, Todd, you jump in there. Good, we haven't heard from you.
Well, I just had a question. Are we saying that Prince Shotoku claimed to be a member of a group, a family group named Soka, or did you actually at some point say Saka or Sakya?
Soka, S O G A is the spelling, and you know that can vary, of course, depending on what consonant you want to add to it. But yeah, that's my research. That's what I've come across very clearly. So, but as David says, it could be just because he wants to help, you know, work on adding some legitimacy to things, or there was indeed some ancient family line or connection. And let me just say this too, David, I'm sure you've heard of this story, how just a few years ago, in fact, they discovered, it came to light, this hidden treasure that was found in an ancient stupa, one of the main stupa, really, out Midiksa, that they were doing some excavation, and they discovered hidden at the base this funerary sort of vase with a number of different artifacts and so forth, including an engraved golden plate from, I think it was a princess of bygone years, maybe even one of Mu Wong's wives, not too clear on that. But another few items that they found in this were said to have been, well, there were these little crystal, gosh, when certain holy people, I guess, are incinerated, sometimes they find these little crystal, their bones crystallize, I guess, and...
Talking about Sarira?
Sari, is that what it's called? Yeah?
Saria, or yep. Sari, Sarira, three different ways to spell it, actually, in different languages. Yes, these are little jewel-like, clear, little, looks like a gem. It seems to be crystallized calcium, crystallized by the fire of cremation. It is said within Buddhist tradition that if you are an enlightened person, a holy saint, that you will leave some of those behind. And this was a tradition throughout Korean Buddhism and through, global Buddhism. It is said that the Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha, the real one, left 3,000 of them. And this is a kind of a key part in the spread of Buddhism. 3,000 of these Sariya jewels were found in his ashes, and they were interred together in one big mound tomb at his death site. But then Emperor Ashoka ordered that tomb to be broken open and took the 3,000, left a few in their original place, but distributed them, started sending them around his empire with missionaries as the way of spreading Buddhism, of making the whole country Buddhist. And these are all the original stupas, the Buddhist stupas that were built all over India up through Afghanistan, Pakistan area, and down to Sri Lanka. Quite a few of these relic pieces, and including other body parts, such as the tooth of the Buddha, famously at the Temple of the Tooth, came to Sri Lanka. These were spread by Ashoka all over his empire, and then they started spreading in the world. Master Jajang supposedly brought some of them, six of them, to Korea in the middle of the 600s after obtaining them in China. Other people have brought some to Korea at different times until today, where there's claims of having more than a dozen of them in different parts of Korea. The latest one, we know for sure, 1912, a monk from Sri Lanka brought a collection of them to Korea and gave one of them to the Korean monks to celebrate the re-legalization of Buddhism after 500 years of being illegal. That Sariya is stored in the stone pagoda of Jogesa Temple in downtown Seoul today.
Very interesting. I did not know that. One of the problems, though, of course, too, as with Catholicism, they're constantly presenting and claiming to be in possession of these ancient saints' relics and so forth. It's pretty tough to authenticate, so that's one of the ongoing issues. Who really knows?
Sariya has never been authenticated. It is a lot like when the medieval Europeans used to talk about having, a splinter of the true cross. Jesus had died on some splinter of wood, and some of those got encased in glass cases in cathedrals. And other pieces of Jesus' robe, and of course the famous Shroud of Turin, and things like that that now are not done such. Great monks have their funeral cremations. They search through the ashes to find those Sariya jewels.
Absolutely, yeah. Todd, go ahead.
Yes, and actually for one brief breathless moment, I thought you were saying that Prince Shotoku was claiming to be a member of the Sakya clan rather than the Soga clan, which would, of course, mean that he was saying that he was a relative of the Buddha himself.
What's the distinction? I'm not clear on that. I'm not sure if anybody really is, maybe one or two. But what is the difference there, Todd, between Soga and Sakya?
Well, I don't know what the Soga clan, ostensibly of Japan, is, but the Sakya clan is the clan. I mean, Buddha is known as Sakyamuni. That means he is.
I think that was being claimed. That is, Soga is still today the Korean pronunciation for Sogamuni. However, we don't know how they would have pronounced it back in the ancient days. Korean language used to be quite different. But this claim that Prince Shotoku said that he's of the Soga clan, I don't know if that's any serious claim that he shares genetics with the Buddha's family from India. I'm thinking probably not. Probably it's just adopting that in order to be more Buddhist, taking it like as an honorary name.
Can't get more Buddhist than that.
That's exactly right. Let's not forget to look at the geographical location of the Gaia. I like to call it a kingdom, I guess. It's generally known as a confederacy, though, so that's fine. But based as it was, the southern central location of the peninsula, they had a continual naval activity occurring from out of there. And with this business of, I mean, that's both going, to the east, to Japan, and in a southerly manner, and up, every four directions and everywhere else that you could possibly imagine. But with the Hoango coming from the Ayodhya location and down the Ganges past Bodh Gaya, well, everyone's heard of the Pillars of Ashoka. We know, too, for those that have looked into it, how fabulous and highly advanced, really kind of top-shelf material the metalwork was, the steel and so forth, maybe even iron, I guess, is what they're working with at that time. But guess what Gaya was known for? And yeah, they were the envy of their neighbors, both Baekje and Shelah. So this might start to, if we connect the dots here a little more, make a little more sense. With the princess, the Hoang-O coming, I'd imagine that she, with these international marriages, the way that they work, would have brought a few things with her as part of her, you know, dowry, if you will. And so this could have been, I'm guessing, one of the things, because it just didn't, you wouldn't imagine these methods just emerged from out of the blue.
No, not to create work like that, no.
David, do you know about that, how Gaya was renowned for its metal and iron work and their manufacture of weapons and other implements?
I wouldn't exaggerate that too much. We don't have any really wonderful, fantastic pieces of metalwork from Gaya in the museums. In fact, they were producing iron, so moving, you know, into an Iron Age civilization. But where they got the technology from, nobody knows. People developed that step by step, and it was certainly China was... It's a lot easier to believe that ships from China were visiting Korean ports than a ship from India, frankly.
No, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't imagine there'd be too many ships from India, but...
iron by 1,000 years before Gaia ever even started to develop, remember? So they developed iron, and maybe a little faster than their neighbors, but we don't have any really great relics of that. As I said, there's nothing exemplary in artworks, or we have some simple swords and patch leather armor and such. No iron breastplates or anything like that, like even that the Greeks had before that era. It was not that advanced.
Cooking utensils, there'd be like bronze bowls and whatnot, as well as, I think, different implements used on horses. Part of their riding gear and equipment, stirrups, and whatnot.
Yes, we have examples of those in the museums.
Yeah, I missed the point about 1,000 years is what you said there, and I tried to jump in, but I couldn't because the lag here didn't work go over too well. So, do you remember what you were hitting on there?
I said that China had developed iron technology and moved into the Iron Age 1,000 years before Gaia ever started to develop even. So, to me, it's just much easier to believe that ships from China had been coming to the Korean coast of, say, Baekje and then around to Gaia Kingdom and such. That's pretty easy to believe and could have brought some iron technology in there. It is not necessary to speculate that it could have come from India, the ability to make iron, because China's right next door and they had iron for 1,000 years already.
If I might interject something here, which is sheer and reckless speculation, but that's the best kind, isn't it? I don't know if you are all familiar with Christopher Beckwith's book, Greek Buddha, but his speculation, and that speculation has been amplified by personages no less than Stephen Batchelor, with whom I know you're all familiar, that... the Buddha was not actually Indian. He was Scythian from the Sakya clan.
Right.
This is why my mind has been calculating ever since the moment I heard Soga. The Scythians were known for many things, one of which was their metalwork. They were supposedly very adept at metalwork. We can add 2 and 2 and leap to 9 or 10 on that and say we found out all sorts of things, but you know, I'm sure it makes good radio, if not bad archaeology.
The warrior class, I'm not sure if there's anyone outside of that, but fighters in particular, major potheads as well, from all accounts.
Potheads,
you've heard of that, have you? The way these the bongs that they've recently discovered, and do you know much about that, Todd? Can you comment?
I understand that the Scythians would put you in a room and just throw bales of weed onto a fire and close all the windows and all the doors, and just you could just have your little marijuana sauna right there and contact the gods. I've heard it argued, and you know, passionately, if not exactly persuasively that the precept against drinking wine is exactly and only that, a precept against alcohol. And the Buddha was quite fine with smoking weed, actually, because as ostensibly a Scythian, he wouldn't dream of interfering with somebody's marijuana habit.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm really following you on that one.
Precept not to indulge in intoxicants.
Right, yes.
That, you know, the argument is that that was very specifically and narrowly not a precept against intoxicants generally, but against against alcohol specifically.
Right, yeah.
And exclusively.
Right.
So that, yeah, according to this individual's interpretation of the precept, marijuana is just fine.
Well, mental confusion, mental clarity, you know, that's really, I guess, the deciding factor. And on top of that, and this is really what gets under my skin, is how Buddhism is all about helping to lessen and ameliorate, to ease the suffering of all sentient beings. So if medical marijuana is going to do that, it is a real, it's an outrage, of course, that prohibition, it's just in Korea, it's only been in place since 1976, if you can imagine that. Thank you, well done, Washington, D.C. Pressure from the States there, I guess, is what made that all come about. So, sure. You know, that's a tricky one, though, with the, you know, for, I've had different teachers explain to me saying that if it's going to help, you know, people that are in pain and suffering, fly at it. You shouldn't really play around with it, though, not necessarily from a recreational standpoint because of the way that it impacts and, you know, it's a problem when it comes to your mental clarity. So,
some of the mountainous regions in, Bhutan and, Tibet have a very long-standing tradition of spiritual marijuana use. So there's the famous Hindu Kush, but there'll be monks that part of their ritual is to grow marijuana plants, and they meditate with the plants, and they hand-roll very small balls of hash for hours on end. But at the same time, it's considered a spiritual enhancement, and there's very, very strict ideas and rules based around that marijuana usage. And I have read in a Encyclopedia of the World's Hash that whatever they're doing up there in the Tibetan mountains is incredibly good, because this guy who wrote the encyclopedia was a seasoned pothead, of course, and he'd been all around the world. And he said when he tried the Buddhist stuff, he said it literally put him on another plane of very high mental clarity, but he said you just would not want to touch it very often, because it was more, to him, it was more of this spiritual trip that you wouldn't want to abuse at all. So that's the tradition in certain parts of the world.
Amazing, and that's great, and I fully embrace that. And to emphasize, when any time conversation like this comes up, and I do try to talk about as much as I can, even here in South Korea, where it's seen as such a great taboo in the minds of all too many, unfortunately, I have no problem speaking out on the matter. Isn't it interesting, too, North Korea, not a problem, completely legal. So let's just leave that aside for the moment, though. But, yeah, from a religious standpoint, it really is an outrage. It's just, there's no excuse for it whatsoever. So hopefully change is coming, but we'll just have to see. It's really a matter, I think, of indoctrination and people waking up to the fact of all that it has to offer. We have quite a few people, or at least, almost 10, actually, which is pretty good just for one of our regular shows here. We have, I'm sorry, guys, but no major drawing cards. That's not a personal affront or anything. But in the past, we've had some, you know, really big, well-known names that have joined us, and we've had as many as 30 people engaged in the live streaming YouTube chat. So at the moment we have occult priestess, which we are always happy to see and, you know, hear from her, of course. Maybe even manage to get her booked on an upcoming show. I think she would make for a great guest. Joe Eminon helping to moderate the chat now at this point. So always need some good quality moderators. Faceless Troll from, I think these are all Minds members too, of course. Well, nobody on Facebook seems to like us for some reason. Joe 333.
The story of my life, Jaffy.
Nobody seems to like us. Hey, well, we're pirates. What do you expect?
I joined Minds only a year ago, and as I've got plenty of friends on there, and everyone on Facebook is under some strange spell put out by Mark Zuckerberg. And perhaps Mossad is sending some weird signals into their minds or something. I don't know, man.
Dale Q. I'm not sure. Todd, this Dale Q character, we haven't had him join us up until this point. Looks like he's got a bit of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva-type avatar, so that's pretty cool. Have him in the house. So big shout-out to all of you, of course. Let's just keep things rolling along here. Time is running short. We have around half an hour. And it's still a lot of ground to cover, but really jumping all over the place here because it is such an amazing discussion topic. Greco-Buddhism, Todd, lasted for the course of around just a little under, I don't know, it's at least 800 years, stemming from Alexander and Manny. I think, is that not the end where Manny had his head lopped off and set on a pike outside the gates of, what was it, Tehran or something like that?
Well, it actually, the last gasp of Buddhism in that part of the world was in the, of Greco-Buddhism, I should say, was the Kushan Empire. So we touched upon Ashoka. We should also touch upon Kanishka, because while they weren't Greeks, they very much modeled themselves on the Hellenic culture, in pretty much the same way that the Romans did. And this would have been during the era of the Roman Empire as well. So, as a matter of fact, I have it. I don't recall which of the council, the second, there were two second councils, and there was one council which Kanishka, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, by the way. I wouldn't want him angry at me. Which he launched Mahayana Buddhism.
Well, I mean, that was a major thing, of course, too. And that's where we really find the tie-in with Christianity and this whole business of Jesus in the missing years. A lot of scholars speculate he was off in India traveling, 18 years. What's going on? So please continue.
I don't know that much about Kanishka. I have it on good authority that he opened that council, the Mahayana council, with an invocation to Apollo, Athena, Zeus, Helios, and Hermes. And, of course, Hercules, or in Greek, Heracles, was the model for the Vajrapani. All Buddha defenders are descendants of Hercules. So there was a lot of influence there. I'm really selling the Greeks hard here, but it happens to be true. So,
Stompy, go ahead.
This is a very interesting angle that you're coming from that I've never heard of before. One of the things with Buddhism is it's, the general tenets of peacefulness in the face of the world and adversity, and the Greeks having a quite martial culture and having the Buddhism mingled with that's interesting because it puts forward the idea that if Buddhism was as prevalent as you say, that they'd probably be a bit more robust in their defense of Buddhism than a lot of other cultures have been. And as we've realized, a lot of Buddhist cultures have capitulated before military cultures after a while.
Indeed. In fact, we saw that with the Muslim invasion. The Brahmins, did all that they could to put an end to this heretical uprising. They felt that it was taking away from their power base or what have you. But the Muslim, was it the Mughals? There was some invasion, I think, around the 7th century.
The Mughals were the later one, but that was part of it, yes.
Well, they really did a number, man, as far as sacking and a lot of destruction and annihilation. Todd, do you know much about that, the Muslim invasion of India and its impact?
Sadly, yes. Sadly, yes. It was one of the most horrible atrocities in human history over a period of centuries. It's amazing that Hinduism survived at all because of its ferocity. You know, we're talking about several Muslim generals and leaders who would do things like invade a territory and make mountains of human skulls just pretty much for kicks.
That's why Ashoka, of course, he embraced Buddhism and felt it was time to promote more a religion of peace. He, in fact, built animal sanctuaries and was really he was an early day naturalist or environmentalist for sure, even opening hospitals for animals, supposedly. But he engaged in war and, I guess, triumphed, if you want to call it that. He was just so appalled and devastated that he felt it was time for a more positive change. So, and then, of course, as a result of that, sent out a number of emissaries, as I think David referred to earlier. David, by the way, has checked out of the conversation. I guess he had an appointment here at 1 o'clock. It is 1 p.m. in South Korea. I guess around 9 p.m. out there in Las Vegas, Friday night. We're on the
yes.
We're kind of living in the future here, though. So, but yeah, these emissaries got sent out, and I guess everywhere they went, pretty much, there were these pillars of Ashoka were put in place. But feel free to like run with any of these threads that are thrown out there as well, Todd. But one of the things that Zane Ivy wants to know, and thank you for joining us today too, by the way, Zane, is when this second, I'm not sure if you would call it, was it ecumenical council? Or basically, what year did Mahayana Buddhism emerge, or when did it find itself founded? Wasn't it in the lead-up to the time of Christ?
Christ was on a slightly different part of the world, but it would have been in the centuries prior to the Christian era. Kanishka would have been about 100 years after the beginning of the Christian era. So we're talking about a slow process. The Greeks had several innovations, and I guess at this point we should differentiate the Greeks in the Gandhara area from those back in Athens or Sparta. They were, for instance, the first to represent the Buddha in human form because they didn't have anything like the reluctance or prohibition against representing the Buddha with anything more than, say, stylized footprints, which you see in early Buddhist art. There is dispute concerning whether the first images of the Buddha were modeled on Apollo or Alexander or one of the many kings who lived there. And it's probably some combination of all of these. But the rise of the Buddha as a divine to semi-divine figure, which is, of course, typical of Mahayana Buddhism and snickered at by the Theravada schools for ever since. But it's a Mahayana specialty, apparently arose out of that era and with the Indo-Greeks. I think that's probably the term I should probably stick with, and was carried forward by the Kushan Empire. And the Kushans were not ethnically Greek, but they were admirers. They were Philhellenes would be the term. I guess I would call myself a Philhellene also.
Lover of the Greeks.
Exactly. You know, and there are also other associations. Apparently, and this is something I'm just now finding out, but it seems likely that the original composition of at least a few of the major Mahayana sutras, for instance, the Lotus Sutra, would have been originally by Indo-Greeks, those monks in that particular region. On the spot, I'm thinking about other Mahayana characteristics, the Bodhisattva vow. I'm not really sure about that. But Hellenic paganism and Buddhism existed either side by side or blended together, or there was some displacement. It's very hard to tell through sheer architecture, especially in that part of the world where architecture is risky and furtive. But something very powerful happened in that part of the world and in that somewhat separated culture for a few hundred years, which apparently is what gave rise to Mahayana Buddhism.
Right. You've heard of the term religious syncretism?
Yes.
Well, this is kind of what we saw, I think. Well, it's occurred in many places throughout the world. Catholic Church has really cashed in on this. South America is a classic example when they were making inroads over there, just with matching up different, you know, gods and goddesses and philosophical concepts and ideas and so forth. But we also found this in the Silk Road region. When Buddhism was first making its way eastwardly, during, I guess it was the Han era. It's too bad David checked out a little early here, unfortunately. But one of the things that they would do would be to take existing ideas and they met Taoists, basically, was what happened. They were traveling east and they met Taoists, and in the Silk Road region and over the course of their journey to the east and China and whatnot. And they seem to have gotten along quite well. I'm not sure if this is in the Dunhuang region where we find the famous caves of Dunhuang, maybe the Taklamakan area, or just across the span of many thousands of miles. But what they would do was just take different ideas that they had in one philosophical tradition and match those with the pre-existing Taoist concepts, principles, ideas, or what have you. Now, Stompy, you said you'd looked into a little bit of Taoism. Have you heard of anything along these lines at all? Things like just like enlightenment or awakening or wisdom or compassion or, you know, because you find in all these wisdom traditions that basic principles, you know, many religions just themselves straight across the board, we're told to practice charity, love, all these virtues, patience, generosity, and so on and so forth. Let's start with Stompy up there in the crow's nest. With the Taoist studies that you've done, anything that you can... have you heard of Han China or looked into the Silk Roads and the meeting, the contact, and synergy that emerged in the meeting of these two traditions?
I've not looked into the Han Dynasty Silk Road thing, but the interesting thing I find, around the time of the Greeks, that was for the West when rational thought began really coming to the forefront of people's consciousness. Before that, people were a little bit, probably what we'd call tribalized and superstitious. And before the Greeks, the way of approaching a lot of things happening in people's consciousness, such as love or hate or greed or this or that, in some way it was represented by some kind of a god, you'd see. So you'd have Athena, patron goddess of intellect, or you'd have Aphrodite as the patron goddess of love. With the Taoist perspective, it was a very interesting development. I'm still absolutely fascinated with it, because it was a much more, it was very spiritual, but it was much more left brain, whereas the more pagan philosophies were very much an imaginative right brain experience. So the right brain, more artistic experience, you tend to embellish it and stylize it, whereas with Taoism, they did have their gods and their representations, but they attempted... I'm trying to say this right here. They attempted to make their spirituality more dry and rational. They tried to get to a reductionist underlying explanation of reality. And with this Greek thing that's happening, that Todd is talking about, you can kind of see Greece is getting more towards the East and the West crossover point. So if you look at the West, we were still quite pagan and right brain in our spiritual outlook, whereas in the East, the Taoist tradition had given a stronger, more left brain, rationalistic spirituality. And the Greeks were the very first people to start trying to work more with a rational outlook on life, on spirituality, on everything. So that was the very interesting thing I found about the emergence of rationalism in Greek culture. People wanted to sit down and they wanted to really get to a fundamental analysis of how do we know that we really know these things? How deeply can we analyze it? Let's sit around and talk about it in a very reductionist, dry sort of manner and see if we can find a way of comparing these experiences and stripping away the illusion, trying to get to the kernel of truth. So not having heard of the East and the West crossover of Buddhism with the Greeks as a kind of nexus point, I'm finding that seems to be some strong grain of truth that the Greeks quite probably were influenced by a Buddhist/Taoist Eastern outlook on their spirituality that helped to potentially change the entire Western outlook over a long time.
I have no doubt whatsoever that played a role and had an impact and was to a large extent the case. So both of you familiar with the Axial Age? This is something, another concept, yes, which ties into this whole business of Greco-Buddhism and Gnosticism too, let's not forget, and this whole idea of, which I think it just, well, knowledge is what it means essentially, but this spiritual awakening, that's really all Buddhism, it's a good central part of what it's about, is waking up. So, you know, which some people that haven't heard it, are not familiar with Buddhism, it's all news to them, I guess, right? But very empirical, too, let's not forget, and the fact how people say, oh, well, it's a religion, it's superstitious, but no, really, I mean, you can look at it in that context and emphasize those parts, but as other traditions, of course, too, where it's very scientific and to the point where you have birth, aging, sickness, suffering, discomfort, old age, and death, right? I mean, that's these are just the facts. So, and the more that we kind of meditate and reflect on this, the better that'll be for everyone in the long term. So let's just see. Hang on a second. Zane, Ivy wanting to engage here and be a little more kind of active, talking about Orpheus. I think this would probably be a little more up Todd's alley. Something that I actually looked into myself a little bit during university, Orpheus and the Roots of Platonism. Wow, how about that?
Yeah.
So, Todd, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I could move in several directions. I might take a little issue with the notion that the Greeks ever stopped being mystical and religious. They've combined rationality and mysticism.
Yes. I did actually mean that, Todd, overall, but it was just a coming out of a more polytheistic era into one based more on rationalism, but you are correct there.
Well, it's interesting is some could say that polytheism is the only kind of theism that really withstands or is invulnerable in a way to a certain kind of rationalistic analysis, but that's a polytheist speaking, and namely me. But if you think about the Axial Age, I don't know when the Axial Age is said to end. When I think of the Axial Age, I think of the Buddha himself, but also Pythagoras, who could not be more religious and could not be more rational at the same time. And he would be the first figure in the Orphico-Platonist tradition who we could say is truly an historical figure. Orpheus is, well, I mean, I'm sure there was an Orpheus, but it was more of a mythical figure. You know, he was an Argonaut, for goodness sake. You don't get much more mythical than that. There was a collision. I should also mention that one of the speculations that Beckwith makes in Greek Buddha, which is, I'd say, least convincing to me, was that the Buddha and Lao Tzu were actually the same person. He bases this on a certain etymological factors that if I actually knew which page that was on, I could actually go get that right now. I know that there was a certain school which is said to have descended very directly from, if not Buddhism itself, then from some of the same sources that Buddhism descended from, and this would be Pyrrhonism, which in Greece turned into a rival of the Platonists. And they were very close to what Buddhism was originally. It was a skeptical school. And this is something that I try to practice myself, where the point is to hold no views rather than to rationally try to find out which is the best view. And I would imagine that sounds very Buddhist to you. The rhymes between Pyrrhonism and Buddhism are so strong and so obvious that it suggests a genetic relationship.
Okay, Beckwith. I heard the name. Don't know if I have any of his books here, or rather if we do here in the ship's library. But the comparison between Buddha and, who is it? Did you say Lao Tzu as being the same character? Historically, I think there's a bit of a, kind of what David was getting at earlier, wanting to lay claim to and have it as if it's more like it's a credibility or legitimacy issue, I suppose, saying, oh, well, we came first. Kind of deal, so therefore we're the
yeah,
right
that's
one.
Right. There's but, always that.
Yeah, sure. Who was it, the founder of Jainism, I tell you? I mean, you look at that story of how that all came about. My God, it really it very much parallels and mimics what we find in Buddhism with the wealthy prince, you know, kind of dropping out, kind of wandering mendicant and seeking truth and so on and so forth. So, unfortunately, I can't really elaborate on that too much. I have to brush up on the whole thing. But have you found that yourself, either of you? I'm not sure. Stompy, have you looked into Jainism? Mahavira, that was his name. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I've not looked into the historicity of Jainism. I've only looked at their beliefs. But well, I would agree that Lao Tzu and Buddha are the same person. It's very far-fetched.
To reach, yeah.
This is just my view. It definitely, to me, seems like Taoism was a little bit first. It has a lot of the hallmarks of a proto-Buddhism. It seems like a foundational structure, and then Buddhism seems to have taken the basics of that and elaborated and added some additional teachings and thinkings and views upon the top of that. Taoism, by the way, is very fluid. Philosophical and practical spirituality, but you could literally be almost anything and be a Taoist. Now, one of the most famous Taoists was a Chinese poet. I forgot his name. He's still one of the most famous today. He was a lunatic. He was a drunk. He ended up drowning when he was 32 years old because he was in some ecstatic state.
Bodhidharma? You talking about Bodhidharma? No, I'm sorry. No. Li Po?
He literally jumped off the ship because he was in love with the moon's image in the water, and he wanted to give the moon a gigantic hug. He was almost this crazy, ecstatic drunkard for his short life, and everything he did was so in the moment and so conscious, and he was able to capture that and write it down as the most brilliant poetry. He's almost a Jim Morrison character of his day. Now, he's one of the greatest Taoists of all time. They consider that's because he lived according to his essential character. His essential spiritual nature was he was a drunken clown and a poet and a buffoon. Taoism, that's like no problem. You could also be a great general in an army and do great deeds that way, become a Taoist. So you could be a man living in a hut on a mountain by yourself for your whole life and come to town once a year and spread some teachings and bring some medicine down, and you'd be a great Taoist. Taoism is essentially very broad, and it's just following the spiritual nature of your essential character.
Todd was saying Li Po. Does that resonate with you with the story that he was presenting there, Todd?
Li Po might be a little bit too late historically. I think Li Po was an 8th century figure, and I think he might be a little bit late to be this poet. I'm throwing out the only... He's the only...
This guy definitely seemed... I remember him being about the 3rd century, and he had that very Zen poetry. But the point I'm trying to make is Buddhism seemed to be a refine... Taoism's very broad, and then Buddhism seemed to refine the more spiritual purification aspect. This is a very broad general description. So Buddhism seems to be the same thing, but is a little bit more focused on the discipline and the refinement into a very pure spiritual state. So
speaking
that's
of
my two cents worth.
Great stuff, man. I mean, this is we're going to have to go back and listen to the show once again and just really kind of meditate and reflect on all the great information that's been presented here today. So, but speaking of being late, Todd, we're kind of running a little late, and there's a few quick points that I really like to kind of just run by people here and present to them, as it were, seeing how it is Buddha's birthday, to some of the theories and ideas that I've got here. Kind of key points that really kind of, if you, as I say, connect the dots and work on tying things together, maybe help to clarify the broader picture. The comparison has been made often between Christ and Buddha, and the fact that, yes, Jesus was a Buddhist monk. A number of documentaries have been put out there via BBC and whatnot. You can easily find on YouTube. In fact, provided links for people there in the streaming chat area. Back in the late 19th century, in fact, I think scholars kind of came across this information and made the connection and seen how there were over 100 parables that were seen to parallel one another from the two traditions. Just a coincidence? I don't think so. Speaking of the mid-19th century, that was around the time where the West first began to get any sense of there being this religious, philosophical tradition called Buddhism. Up until that point, it had been completely lost in, largely, I guess, in the jungles of, I guess, northern India, and that had all these great temples and so forth. I'm not sure about even probably, I think, Nalanda University had been covered up and just all this growth and so forth. The jungle had totally swallowed it up for pushing almost 1,000 years is my take on things. But that's when all of this started to come to light, and scholars and Orientalists, people that had worked on forming the first Asiatic societies, these are the British surveyors, engineers and whatnot, that found themselves as part of the British Empire serving in northern India. They started to make these connections between not only that particular, the Gandhar region and so forth, but also Burma, Thailand, and Cambodia, Sri Lanka, you name it. And just coming to see and understand that this is the same character they're talking about. It's a little different, though, these traditions that have emerged, but it's all part of the same kind of thing that has been lost to the world for so long. So let's see now. Bodhidharma, too. I'm not sure if you know about this. Todd, you might. But then, in fact, according to Chinese texts, he was known as the Blue-Eyed Barbarian. I find that quite interesting, speaking of red-headed mummies and so forth that were just uncovered and discovered. These are the Chinese texts, too, that they thought he was kind of he was quite borderline insane and whatnot, but I think he had a hand in helping to found the Shaolin Monastery, among other things. We don't really have time at this particular moment to go into any great detail as far as his history and his impact on, you know, the Zen tradition in particular is concerned. But there's also, I'm not sure, a lot of people don't know about these ancient, I think it was around 6th century Buddha statues. Well, I think it might have just been one and maybe even a few coins on top of that that were found inside this Viking horde in Sweden, of all places.
That's right.
Late 1940s. So we got that going on. Makes it kind of leaves me scratching my head. And on top of that, to the east in Osaka, we find these ancient Roman coins being uncovered. So maybe sometime around that same period. So it just goes to show, I mean, who knows what all these that has yet to be uncovered. But I know Stompy, he and I are a couple of people, along with what has been done in the field of archaeology as far as looking at the present time and age that we live in as being the age of apocalypse. Not a bad thing. Don't have to get all freaked out, people, and start running around all hysterically. But, yeah, no, it's just an uncovering, unveiling. So, yeah, that archaeology has been very instrumental in doing that. The Shila crown, the Shila dynasty, it might even go further back from that time period. This is in Korea, of course, too, but they found an exact replica. Where, of all places? Afghanistan. So this is a royal crown that is in the Korean museums here. And where do they find an exact replica? Way the heck over in Afghanistan. So what's up with that? You know, that's really quite something. So, you know, speaking of international marriages and alliances and trade and commerce and cultural exchanges and whatnot. Sorry, I'm just quickly rattling off a few points here because, and then we'll let you guys close off. Just one last quick point here. The Dalai Lama himself, talking about this time, has acknowledged that, in fact, yeah, there were monks coming from Korea to Nalanda. This is during the emergence, of course, I guess 7th, 8th, 9th century, the Vajra and Tantric traditions. I think those two are interchangeable, really. But they found themselves visiting Nalanda, all kinds of exchanges, intellectual, philosophical, whatnot, occurring there. And it's really interesting because up until the time, once again, it's too bad that David checked that a little early, but I have no idea. I've been looking into it because it's quite, I don't know where I heard it to begin with, but there is a tantric tradition here, Vajrayana, in Korea. I was in Gyeongju, the former capital of the Silla dynasty. It's off on the east coast. And let's not forget, that city played a really key and pivotal role in the Silk Road tradition and history. The Silk Road did not just end somewhere up in, you know, south central China or whatnot. It continued all the way down through to the city of Gyeongju and over to Japan. So people might want to look into that a little more. But what we've got here is Padmasambhava. It's Jijang Bosar, which is the same as Vairochana. Todd, you might want to make a note of that.
I will make a note of that. Yeah. Could you repeat a little bit of that last bit there?
Well,
what just preceded Vairochana?
Oh, it's a Korean. It's a Jijang Bosar, which I think if the wife was here, I could ask her exactly. But the Mahamudra is what they've got inscripted and written on the back. It's a little wooden plate that I purchased at a Buddhist implement and gift store, basically, in Gyeongju when we made a visit there on a bit of a holiday excursion a number of years ago. So the Mahamudra, which anyone that studied the Tibetan tradition will be hopefully, you know, somewhat familiar with. Padmasambhava is what they've got written on here as well in Korean. So just like I said, it's all about connecting the dots here and just picking up on these little hints and indicators that suggest that there's a perhaps something more going on here behind the scenes and historically than what the official kind of mainstream narrative people and those who control, because really it's all about mind control. That's what it comes down to. It's like, well, or who's going to control my mind, me or somebody else? So often we leave it to others.
It's also very much about information control, Jaffe.
Right. Yes.
There's things that they want us to know, and there's things that they don't want us to know.
Absolutely.
Just a very quick thing on these blue-eyed, red-haired barbarians is they get around a lot because the very first Spanish expedition in their ships to Polynesia was about 1564 or something, very early. They got to the Polynesian islands. This is recorded in their own diaries. As most of the island was black, typically Polynesian people, and the queen of one of the islands was a fair-skinned, red-haired, blue-eyed woman. It was recorded the islanders all had this thing going that she was one of the gods who'd come from somewhere else. And there was a scattering of a small amount of red-haired, fair people on the Polynesian islands with a whole bunch of myths connected to them. So whatever's going on, I did not know about the Greek connection to the Buddhism, but there was some red-haired, blue-eyed people. They were getting around and they were getting into a lot of things, and they obviously weren't just a bunch of grunts or foot soldiers. They were obviously very intelligent people, some of them.
Yeah, I think, and once again, you know, Todd's talked about this, the Taklamakan region, or where we typically expect to see up in the north central Asian area, maybe this very little known tribe of folks that were descendants, I guess, of one of Alexander's generals, and he had a big impact, Alexander the Great. So last point before we wrap up. Once again, we'll let you, both of you, get your, if you have any plugs, upcoming gigs, or things you want people to know about, let you have a chance to do that. And don't forget, Todd, we've got another show coming up here we've talked about behind the scenes, so we'll have to follow up on that a little more. Actually, you can plug it here in just a second, but let me just say, going back to Miduksa, the whole name, the Miduk, actually means Bodhisattva. There's this prophecy, I guess, and I'm really curious about the whole thing, trying to work on better getting to the bottom of it all, but that there would emerge some sort of bodhisattva in later days, you know, who would work on helping people in a dramatic fashion. So who knows what to make of these things, though, really. It could all be just a lot of poppycock and just so whatnot. But, you know, hey, I mean, you never know. So we'll just have to keep our eye on that one. Yeah, so quickly, Todd, what's a show that you've got in mind? You're thinking of doing something here with us here, and we've kind of discussed a little bit. And what exactly were you hoping that we could kind of better dive into next time we manage to hook up here?
Well, I'm interested in, and I'm in tandem with a friend of mine in Baltimore who is actually currently in Japan, the intersection of Buddhism and modern paganism. In my case, that would be polytheism. The very word paganism seems to be fading among my circle, but not among his circle. And it is an interesting and fruitful connection. And in my case, that involves religion and philosophy. I'm working on an online mandala on Facebook, which is probably a little confusing to anyone who just happens to find it. But it's about that, and it's about my own religious practice, which is coming out of a lot of the things that we've spoken about already. And that's really what we're talking about. I'll add to any listeners in Korea who might be feeling dispossessed by, you know, are talking about how everything comes from Greece originally. Perhaps they can take some solace that there is a very prominent scholar by the name of Peter Kingsley who argues that the Greek god Apollo himself originally was worshipped in either Mongolia or Tibet, and that everything that touches upon his winter resting home, Hyperborea, is actually a reference to Mongolia or Tibet and that region. So if you're Asian and you're listening, you can take heart that perhaps Apollo is yours.
Okay.
That was two really wildly conflated points, but why not?
Well, no, and this is we'd like to follow up on all of things, you know, like this and many more, of course, here as time goes on, but it's going to have to be another day, of course. We can maybe do it in a little bit more in the after show if you stick around for that. So we do have the Rogues Gallery. It usually lasts for about an hour is kind of what we're working on, trying to keep it to about that time frame, more or less. If people can only stick around for a few minutes, that's fine, too. But Stompy, anything you'd like to close with?
Yeah, sure. My Tibetan friends here in Australia, they're refugees, and one guy, Wangil especially, very good terms with him. As time's getting more volatile, you know, there's a certain end times feeling, not just coming into the Christian aspect of life, but many people are. My friend Wangil is as a Tibetan Buddhist, sometimes feels this way as well, and he has some very good advice. The other day when North Korea, and there's supposedly, you know, in the media there's all this supposed paranoia and tensions and this. He said to me, Stompy, make sure you be happy and enjoy your life, because some days it looks like maybe we won't have many more days left on Earth. And to me that's one of the greatest teachings of many strands of Buddhism, is that life is finite, life is unpredictable, life can be short and we don't know what's going to go on. So as the Buddha himself said, he said, when he said enjoy yourself, he didn't mean just be some hedonistic pig. He said it meant to find your own niche, to find your own spiritual path, and to have the realization in the forefront of your mind that you'll never know what is going to happen to you. So you enjoy what you're doing, who you are. When these very bad, threatening situations come, then it's not such a shock to your soul to face up to them in the end, because you already acknowledge that life can be short, nasty and brutish sometimes, and even if your life ends that way, if you've got a good life behind you, it's not going to affect you so much in the afterlife.
Yeah, well, you know, be here now, as well as, of course, work your salvation out with diligence. Those were the Buddha's, some of his really most famous last words. So, happy birthday, Todd. That's pretty auspicious. I mean, hey, you are the Buddha.
Happy birthday to Buddha.
Yeah, that's great. The Vegas, the Las Vegas Sin City-based Buddha. So I'm just blown away by that whole thing. But maybe we can get into a little more as far as some great stories and further anecdotes and bits of information and details regarding the material that we've covered here today in the after show. In the meantime, folks, I think that's about it. And we're going to call it a wrap. We've got the outro queued up here. So on behalf of Pirate Radio Podcasts and everyone assembled here today on the Robin Hood, I've had a really great time. Come again?
I said, and Buddha.
Yeah, Buddha and all the Bodhisattvas and all those great spiritual angelic helpers out there. It's been a hoot. So we'll hope to meet up in the after show. Thanks once again. All the best.
God bless.
Take good care. Blessings to you also. Bye, Lord Stompy.
Bye.
Bye, ye buckos. Once again, that about does it for another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. If you're looking for a little more online action, keep in mind we've likely got another great Rogues Gallery After Show coming up next in Skype. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the work we've produced over the past year plus, you might want to drop by our new Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Since April 1st, we've picked up two official patrons and would really love to keep those numbers growing. For the same price as a cup of coffee, you can help keep the Robin Hood sailing smoothly along each month. All it takes is a buck a week for anyone to win access to our regular behind-the-scenes premium Rogues Gallery content. Coming up next week, same time as always, we have American constitutionalist, blogger, freedom activist, and pro-liberty troll, the real Randy Ross. We've booked paranormal investigator Deborah Rosso for the 19th, with martial arts master and magician James Heidrick rounding off our jam-packed May schedule. If you yourself have an intriguing idea for a guest or story, either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via pirateoneradio@gmail.com. WPRPN.com subdomain links are also now available. Great for artists, musicians, podcasters, bloggers, or pretty much just anyone looking to boost their online visibility and reach. Basic accounts can be launched for only $15 a year. Staking your claim now helps not only strengthen you and the network, we're also looking out for the little guy. That's right, folks. Half of all WPRPN's profits are redirected right back into the hands of community charity. After all, we are the Robin Hood. You can further embark on your own pirate journey by liking, subscribing, commenting on, sharing, and following any of our main social media channels via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google+, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally ho.